Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is Side 2 of For the Record Program number 685, interview number 4 with Elizabeth Gould and Paul Fitzgerald, the author of Invisible History, Afghanistan's Untold Story, just released in soft cover by City Lights Books. Elizabeth and Paul, welcome back once again to our airwaves.
Well, thank you, Dave.
Thanks, Dave.
When we left off on Side 2, we were talking about the various numerical points. You take a number of large points or significant points and number them, and these are recommendations to President Obama. And one of the things we were talking about when we left off, and that is the Pakistani role in this entire thing. Of course, people can tune in a television broadcast or a radio broadcast, or they can pick up a newspaper or go to the internet and read about the war news that's unfolding in Afghanistan right this minute. American fighting forces as well as NATO fighting forces are engaged in combat against the Taliban. And yet one of our major allies in the war on terror, and it goes through that concept is something you addressed, is Pakistan and of course also Saudi Arabia. And as you point out, the Taliban are basically an extension of the Pakistani national security establishment. So why don't we start in with this? I don't know if Orwellian or Lewis and Carroll would be quite the precedent for something like this, but it is as bizarre as it is potentially deadly.
There's no question about that, and that is finally being recognized by, you know, some of the people. Bruce Rydell, the creator of AFPAC, actually looks at that situation and he's got a lot of stuff out there right now, and he's looking at the situation and saying, you know, our relationship with Afghanistan has really kind of been this on again, off again relationship, but the truth is that on a covert basis, it's always been on. It's been on since 1947. One of the things we cite in the book is an example where at the end of World War II, the British military introduced the Punjabi military leaders to the Americans and said, these are our guys, these are the guys you're going to be working with, they're going to hold fast to the principles and the policies of what's going on and what we were trying to establish in India. And you're going to pick up that responsibility. So the United States didn't even blink at that. The United States was eager to pick these things up. But, of course, it didn't have the 100-year history as of 1847, 110-year history that the British had there, and the background and the sophistication in terms of dealing with the great game, dealing with the sophisticated game that was being played between all these tribal groups, between the Pashtuns and the Punjabis and between the Tajiks and the Hazara, and the various issues surrounding Afghan nationality, which had existed since 1747. And, of course, what's happened since 1947 and Pakistan's creation with the partition of India is that Pakistan has tried to pretend that it was Afghanistan that wasn't a real nation. And you read in the documentation the attitude that were taken by Pakistani's leaders when they were set up. Of course, the Pakistanis are backed by Britain and they're backed by the United States. And in 1947, Afghanistan is nothing but this small nation the size of Texas that is pretty much on its own. It's trying to maintain its independence against British colonialism and against the Soviet Union. And it's sitting there, and it's being dictated to by Pakistanis. At one point, I think we cited it in the book, a representative from the Afghan government went over to the Pakistani government and sat down, and they said, look, there's a lot of issues we need to resolve. This was early on, 1948, 1949. We need to resolve these issues. And the Pakistani general just stood up at his desk, and he says, I can have my troops in Kabul in an hour if I really wanted to. And that was it. The Afghan diplomat, who was the brother of the prime minister, just simply packed up his briefcase and said, well, that's going to be it. That's going to be it. And that was the beginning of it.
But as bad as that was at the beginning, one difference that needs to be recognized is that throughout the 50s and the 60s, and even, you know, into the 70s, you had basically a secular military in Pakistan. But what President Zia brought in was an Islamizing factor. And that is where the whole thing really morphed into something else, where the pan-Islamic agenda that involved the Islamists. And so, you know, you're looking at the United States getting involved in a shift in the process and really was quite willing. In fact, that was part of what the United States and its what it supported, certainly through the CIA's involvement with Pakistan's intelligence, definitely supported the idea that these extremist Islamists were necessary in order to beat the Soviets in Afghanistan. And so, you know, you begin to see a process that's just kind of rolling off on its own. But again, because when this occurred, there was no oversight. There was no American press looking at the situation, analyzing it, bringing the information home, getting it into the hands of the public and into the policymakers who could then deal with the true implications of what was going on. The whole thing was just thrown into that. Once again, the dualism was thrown into the good against evil. We're now at war with the evil empire, and the Mujahideen were simply labeled holy warriors. And that was the end of the discussion.
I think Celik Harrison gave is a long-term Afghan hand. He was the Washington Post's bureau chief, South Asia bureau chief, for many, many years, and he is now in Washington at a think tank. And he stated something recently. He summed up why the situation is so bad in between Afghanistan and the United States and Pakistan. And he talked about in March of 1945, Winston Churchill and the British General Staff decided that partition was necessary for strategic reasons. They deliberately set out to create Pakistan because Muhammad al-Jinnah had promised to provide military facilities and Nehru refused to do so. So this is why Britain became why the United States became allied with Pakistan instead of India during that time period. This is the key to understanding why Pakistan is so dysfunctional. It's an artificial political entity. The British put together five ethnic groups that had never coexisted before in the same body politic politically. The Bengalis were the biggest. They outnumbered all the other four combined, the Punjabis, the Pashtuns, the Baluch, and the Sindhis. Five became four, of course, when Bangladesh succeeded. The army bequeathed by the British to Pakistan was overwhelmingly dominated by Punjabi officers and soldiers. So, with the Bengalis gone, the Baluch, Pashtun, and Sindhis have faced a cruel historical irony. For centuries, they had resisted the incursions of the Mughals into their territories, but now they find themselves ruled by Punjabis who invoke the grandeur of the Mughals to justify their power. Together, the three ethnic minorities constitute only 33% of the population, but they consider 72% of Pakistan's territory to be their ancestral home. This is a prescription for built-in conflict.
It certainly sounds like, it certainly is a prescription for built-in conflict. And one of the things to remember, one of the things people should keep in mind, obviously there is someone that lived through the Vietnam War and with the sanctuaries that have existed for Taliban / Al-Qaeda in the tribal areas, of course, is very reminiscent of some of the geopolitics that obtained during the Vietnam War period. But there's the issue of nukes. Pakistan may be an artificial country. It may be, in many ways, something of a chimera, if I may be mispronouncing that. But Pakistan is a nuclear power. And with them actively promoting some of these elements like the Taliban and other Islamic extremists, that is something to give serious, serious thought to. And I think it's one of the things that distinguishes the current situation in Afghanistan from Vietnam.
It raises serious questions about how that even happened. And that's all part of, again, the self-fulfilling prophecy. Since it has nuclear power, therefore we cannot actually deal with them in the manner they need to be dealt with. So, it seems to set up a condition that makes it impossible to change the condition.
Yeah, well, it's interesting. Bruce Rydell, I mentioned him earlier, he came out with a piece on the national interest a short time ago, back in June, and his title was Armageddon in Islamabad. And he says, I now think Al-Qaeda can be marching. Benazir Bhutto, he starts out by saying, Benazir Bhutto said in 2007, I think Al-Qaeda can now be marching on Islamabad in 2 to 4 years. Before this interview could even be published, she was murdered, most likely by Pakistani Taliban and Al-Qaeda ally. Pakistan as an Islamic extremist safe haven would bolster al-Qaeda's capabilities tenfold. The jihadist threat bred in Afghanistan would be a cakewalk in comparison. The old Afghan sanctuary was remote, landlocked, and weak. A new one in Pakistan would be in the Islamic mainstream with a modern communications and transportation infrastructure linking it to the world. the threat would be almost unfathomable. The implications would be literally felt around the globe. American options for dealing with such a state would be limited and costly. He goes on to explain. Now, Bruce Rydell is the architect of AFPAC. He came in with the Obama administration and has been developing these theories for years. But, you know, the fact is that, as we've discussed earlier, Dave, is that, you know, Pakistan, Afghanistan is no Vietnam. And in terms of the greater situation and America's position in the world, following the defeat in Vietnam, the United States pretty much went along, the world went along pretty much as it had been before. And the truth was is that, you know, when you really looked at the Vietnam situation, you know, it was really an issue of a civil war between North and South, and that that Ho Chi Minh had just devoted himself to unifying his country and creating one nation. That is not the case here. We are dealing with an international movement of extremist movement, which is bent on conquest of a large swath of area from the so-called Arc of Crisis, the northern boundaries of Eurasia, Tajikistan, Uzbekistan, Turkmenistan, all the way down into Africa.
And we can thank Dr. Zbigniew Brzezinski for really inaugurating this and putting it into this last final stage, because this is really where the whole relationship between, you know, he pulled in the China card, you know, the whole idea of inviting the Islamists, you know, the Al-Qaeda database that was used by the United States and the Saudis to invite the Islamists, that they actually came up with a theory that believed it was best to do this, to create this pot, this stew of Islamic extremists in Pakistan.
You know,
basically.
you must recall that in the fall of 1979, right prior to the Soviet and so-called invasion of Afghanistan, that, you know, Pakistan had the American embassy had been burnt to the ground in Islamabad. Pakistan had become a pariah state in the West in terms of their nuclear weapons programs, in terms of their support for various terror groups that were involved in India and Afghanistan. But when the Soviets invaded Afghanistan, once again, this is one of the things we noticed, it was like a light bulb went on. Suddenly, oh my God, we have to align ourselves with Pakistan against the Soviet invasion. Of course, so, you know, this is the way history is made. It's manufactured, and that's what this was. This was a manufactured situation whereby there were large forces at work. And I know that one of the things you mentioned about that was the, you know, that you wanted to discuss was the, you know, how these organizations work as proxies for larger Western goals. And I think that this is one of the examples. It's almost a mirror image. I mean, if you look at what's happened in Afghanistan, the way we supported these extremist groups and encouraged them and introduced them to various kinds of international trade routes for access for exports of their main product in order to fund their efforts, all these things that were done, and then looked the other way, of course, when all these things happened. And then when they defeated the Soviet Union, looked the other way when they tried to establish a government. These are the various things that, you know, they're very convenient. What is the term, credible deniability? You know, the United States, the CIA, has credible deniability when it comes to saying, you know, that the United States really wasn't behind the creation of the Taliban, or really weren't behind the creation of these international organizations, simply because they had been privatized, of course, at that point, as we discussed before in some of the earlier programs, is that these organizations had been privatized intentionally in order to avoid implicating governments in Europe or the United States. And as a result of that, we are now living with that kind of privatization to the point where American involvement, and I say that, quote, American involvement, is really almost like a public relations moniker for what we're involved in. There are so many privatized interests that have become established in that area, whether it's the international narcotics trade or whether it's the international oil industry and the pipeline industry. You know, these are all things that have all combined their interests. Make strange bedfellows, I guess is what you could say. But, you know, the freedom-loving, independent American administrations getting together with Wahhabist Saudi Arabians in the name of defeating communism is one thing back in the 1980s, but now suddenly it gets very complicated when we're dealing with with extremist Muslim politicians that we want to work with on the one hand in places like Pakistan and Afghanistan, and then those guys, those extremist Muslim politicians who basically want to overthrow Western installed democracies or Western backed democracies in that part of the world as well. So we're treading a very fine line, and the United States has been doing that since the Clinton administration, trying to pick so-called good Taliban from the bad Taliban, and of course at the same time fight Al-Qaeda. You know, a recent analysis by someone basically said that at this point the difference that the United States and Pakistan are really not on the same page on this issue, because the good Taliban to Pakistan, the good Taliban are the Taliban that attack NATO and the United States forces, and the bad Taliban are their own Taliban, which attacks the Pakistani military. So, you know, we're dealing with a very confused and very confusing situation. And it's hard to see how that's actually going to straighten out in the near future.
This, again, just to emphasize why it's so critical to understand the Pakistani role in this, its relationship to the United States, and how that really is still playing out today and still interfering with anything that really can bring the kind of stability and rebuilding we need in Afghanistan.
And that really kind of gets us to the next point, the next series of points, and that is getting everybody on the same page, and that everybody is not just Pakistan and the United States and Afghanistan. It's also Russia, China, Iran, all the interests, India, the various nations who have an interest in that region and trying to create some kind of stability. I mean, everybody has an interest in stability in that region.
But you see, once again, this is where Zbigniew Brzezinski really comes up and the kind of agenda that he would look at, which would prefer to keep the containment theories of the Cold War era still in play in that region, which means keeping Russia out as a real active partner and keeping China in some kind of tight control vis-a-vis the United States. So, in terms of trying to bring genuine stability to the region versus continuing effectively the great game is really part of the, what we're realizing is still at play very much, especially with Brzezinski. And he's still influencing the Obama administration.
Two quick points of the many recommendations that you make. Some people have advocated negotiating with the Taliban, and you highlight just how problematic that can be because you cite the fates of some of those would-be negotiators.
Yes, exactly. The fact is that who exactly the Taliban are is not an established issue. Once again, there's been a lot of public relations. Pakistan's military is well known for its very advanced public relations campaign in terms of advancing its own interests in the Western media. In fact, Richard Holbrooke just recently complained that both the Indian and Pakistani lobbyists in Washington were really inhibiting him in terms of his ability to make adequate foreign policy for and resolve issues in that part of the world for Afghanistan. So Afghanistan has always kind of been the odd man out when it comes to that sort of thing, and that continues to be the case.
You make a very interesting recommendation, or actually I think you cite a recommendation made by someone else, to deal with the narcotics traffic.
Well, the narcotics traffic at this point is also something that is up for grabs. The Bush administration was in favor of actually burning down crops or defoliating crops of Afghan peasants. This was, of course, another self-defeating example of policy coming out of Washington, whereby they were attacking the poorest link in the chain, the poor Afghan farmers who had no other means of livelihood. And as a result of that, they were easily recruited for the Taliban, not to mention the fact that the drugs they were using to defoliate were sickening their cattle and the children who lived in these various areas where the United States was spraying this stuff. And so as a result of that, that has really proved – that's pretty much shifted around at this point. I believe the Obama administration has now announced, I believe as of a week ago anyway, that they've announced that they're going to start tracking drug traffickers – following these people and into Pakistan and other parts of the world where these traffickers are moving, because they are responsible for supporting and supplying the money for the insurgency at this point. Everything is linked to everything else in this process. And so the issue is, what do you do with the poor Afghan farmer or the poor Pakistani farmer whose life relies on growing drugs, on growing opium as an example, to turn into heroin?
And this does tie back in again, the lack of the proper reconstruction, the roads being rebuilt is one of the key reasons that many of these farmers were stuck. The only cash crop that they could grow were the poppies, because the poppies were always, they could always sell them, but they could not get their fresh produce to market because the roads were destroyed. So this once again is just showing you how it perpetuates the problem, because the fundamentals have not been done.
And needless to say, for, you know, in terms of, you know, supplying troops versus going in there and actually paying the Afghan farmers and buying their crops from them, while at the same time giving them the opportunity to plant other crops, providing them with the seed, with the manufacturing equipment so that they can get their fields plowed. These are things that the United States could do. I mean, we have, and I read just today where we've got this massive overcapacity in terms of our industrial output. I mean, we've got factory capacity that simply cannot be matched. We could be producing, as an example, tractors or just, you know, very small scale manufacturing operations that could be producing these things very inexpensively for places like Afghanistan. It's an issue of economics. There's just no interest in the world financial markets to actually resolving these problems in a practical way. We certainly have the technology. We have the people who know how to do it. There's just simply no will on behalf of the financial movers and shakers in this globe to start sharing the wealth in some very fundamental basic ways. And once again, that plays into the 21st chapter. That plays into the idea that we're really going to have to, unless we're going to spend the rest of our days here warring with each other and manufacturing weapons of mass destruction everywhere, or even minor destruction in supplying everybody in the world with a Kalashnikov, I'd rather much see everyone in who needs one to start their own farming operation be supplied with a tractor than a Kalashnikov. I think it would be much more practical and much more useful, at least for the long term anyway, which is, I think, what most of us are in it for.
21st chapter. We've got about 7-8 minutes left in the interview. Tell us what the 21st chapter alludes to, and let's see if we can, in these last couple of minutes, sort of provide a 21st chapter for this interview, which many people may have found overwhelming and or depressing.
Well, we didn't want to overwhelm or depress anybody, as you know, Dave. We're very upbeat about the future and the potential for human beings. And that plays very much into what the idea of the 21st chapter came from. When we went back to Afghanistan in 2002 with Seema Wali to film her story, her return, she was the first exile out of Afghanistan in 1978 after the Marxist coup, because her family had been aligned with the West and with the United States specifically. The hotel we were staying at had whitewashed walls, and there was a local Afghan artist who was painting on the walls of the stairwell. And the first week we were there, he painted the New York City Fire Department logo, and the second week we were there, on the second floor stairwell, he painted the New York Police Department logo. And the third week we were there, as we're walking up to our rooms at the end of the day, he's painting the image of the villain from the 1970 Stanley Kubrick movie A Clockwork Orange, with the face, the English gentleman, Alec was his name, Alexander Delarge, with his bowler hat and his grin, and wicked grin, and pointing a knife out towards you. And I thought to myself, what a strange thing to be doing. The book had been written, of course, by Anthony Burgess in the 1960s. And it was very much, I remember reading it, I'm sure you read it back then. Mm-hmm. Burgess invented an entire language, and it was all about the evolution of what was happening to Britain and Western society, Western civilization. And it was a mockery of how the youth of the era were mocking the times and the efforts by the bureaucracy to establish law and order and justice, when they knew full well that it was nothing but total hypocrisy, that they weren't establishing anything that was really worth any value of restoring. And there were allusions in the movie and in the book about, you know, the kind of control that the state was imposing upon people, the use of violence, bringing thugs into the police force in order to administer violence upon the population at will, in order to control them. And so this one, when I saw that, I went back and I bought another copy of the book, and we reread the book, and there Anthony Burgess mentions the fact in a new introduction to the book, which he'd written quite late on in the early 1990s, that the book was published in the United States with only 20 chapters. Everywhere else in the world, the book had been published with 21 chapters, the 21st chapter being the chapter of redemption, that the evil Alex had reached the age of 21, and the violence that he had experienced and that he so craved and loved as he was growing up as a youth, what he referred to as the ultra-violence, he began to develop a distaste for. And he attributed that, Kubrick attributed that to Stanley Kubrick in the movie attributed that, rather Burgess attributed that to the whole idea that, you know, this was something that the human race was, that we actually were evolving as human beings and that we were evolving as society, and that when we somehow would reach the 21st century, that we would evolve out of the desire to solve our problems through violence. Well, unfortunately, Kubrick made the movie with only 20 chapters, with only the 20th chapter, in which he meant it as a political metaphor. And in fact, he states that. He says that during the time period when it was being done, he said his book was Kennedyan in the sense that it saw that every human being had the ability to refine himself and reform himself into something better, that we could make a better world, but that the movie had turned out to be very Nixonian, that it was very much evil prancing on the page from the very beginning until the very end. So that became a metaphor for what we felt Afghanistan was really all about. Here, the United States in 2001 winds up in this place that has been under siege by Western civilization since Alexander the Great in the third millennium BC. And here we are, finally, in August of 2009, with the general who is in charge of the ultra-violence which we are wielding upon the Afghan people, is finally saying, we can't win this thing militarily, especially if we are using violence to hurt the Afghan people. We have to suddenly change the way in which we do it. So this is a very, very, very critical moment in time, not just for Afghanistan and America's involvement there, but as you know, for the United States as well, in terms of whether we can mature as a society and a civilization. And we must recall as well what the 21st chapter meant to the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union did not survive its effort in Afghanistan. It went in there with its own ideals and its own principles, with the intention of turning Afghanistan into a pro-Soviet socialist state. That didn't happen. But the United States seems to be very unclear as to what exactly it wants to do in Afghanistan and what it wants to do with its ally Pakistan, and whether it wants to advance the cause of extremist Islam, which it did in the 1980s, or whether it really wants to establish a modern westernized state, which we know from our own experience is very much what the Afghan people want, despite what we hear from a lot of people in the media. We know full well that the Afghan people are very much involved with democracy and always have been, and that their efforts to establish an independent state has been at issue from the very beginning, and that's what we need to get behind if there's going to be an end to this conflict.
And so we are almost out of time. Give us the website. And by the way, we have in these four interviews just scratched the surface of the book. I think we've done a pretty good job of laying out information, but there's a whole lot more there. Tell the audience where they can find it.
Well, you can find the book and a lot more information about us at invisiblehistory.com.
And hopefully the audience themselves can become the 21st chapter for this entire story.
Well, it's going to take all of us to do it.
Exactly.
That's for sure, and that's why we wrote the book.
Well, you've done a magnificent job, and with holiday season looming on the horizon, I can't encourage people strongly enough to consider this book as a holiday gift for whatever faith or in the context that you give such gifts. We have been visiting with Elizabeth Gould and Paul Fitzgerald, the co-authors of Invisible History, Afghanistan's Untold Story, just out in softcover by City Lights Books. This concludes Side 2 of For the Record, program number 685, interview number 4 with Elizabeth Gould and Paul Fitzgerald. For Paul and Elizabeth, this is Dave Emery saying thanks for listening.